Good evening, I'm Dave Marshall and I'm here at the Paleontological Association Annual General Meeting, which is being hosted here in Ireland this year at the University College Dublin. The Paleontological Association, or PAS for short, is one of the organisations who have funded Paleocast, so it's a great honour for me to be here. PALAS are a UK-based organisation and registered charity set up in 1957 to promote the study of paleontology and its allied sciences through the publication of their journal, Paleontology, and through a whole suite of other publications, meetings and charitable activities. There's about 1,000 members, not just from the UK but worldwide, with diverse research interests, which is reflected both in the journal, Paleontology, and also here in the talks over these 3 days. So, I'm here at the drinks reception at the end of the first day. There's quite a lot of people here, as you can hear. There's a lot of mulled wine being drunk, and there's these fantastic little pancake things with chocolate sauce and marshmallows, which I think I may be the only one eating, or I may have just had them all. So, a lot of the talks today, all the talks today were on the theme of taphonomy and the fidelity of the fossil record. And as a paleontologist myself, I have to admit that it's often very easy to view fossilised organisms as I would do living organisms. It's very easy to compare the two. But the one thing that you've got to remember is that the thing that all fossils have in common, and that's that they're dead. And you always have to view them as dead things. You can't always look at them as living organisms. And taphonomy is the study of how organisms decay and become preserved in rocks. So all the processes that occur between the time when it actually dies and the time when it actually becomes preserved in a rock is taphonomy. And also, the fossil record is very biased towards certain organisms. Certain tissues and chemistries are preferentially preserved over other ones. And we're actually missing quite a lot of the fossil record, not just in terms of the things that aren't preserved, but also in terms of rocks that are missing, that have been since eroded or weathered or never preserved in the first place. You don't always get rocks preserved. You have to have certain environments, kind of like within fossils, where you can get the rocks preserved. So this first day really focused on these problems, and we've heard from Derek Briggs, Alan Channing, Susan Kidwell, Maria McNamara, which hopefully you'll all remember, Rob Sanson and Clive Truman, who are all big names in the paleontological world. And then after this, we actually had the annual address by Professor Chris Stringer of the Natural History Museum in London. And he was discussing the new views on the origins of our species. So it's pretty nice that we had this, because there's a bit of a blurred margin between anthropology, which is the study of humans and their ancestors, and paleontology. And so universities will often have different departments for the two fields, and they always tend to be addressed separately. So it's pretty good to get the insights into this closely related but parallel field. So Professor Stringer was reviewing the out of Africa hypothesis and the effect that a new Asian hominid population, which were called the Denisovans, I think that's pronounced right, and the effect that they were having upon the evolutionary and species models that we had for our species. And so I won't go too much into it now, as hopefully we can cover some of this kind of thing in the future. As for what we're doing here, we've got a stall all set up at the conference, and we're going to try and talk to some of the paleontologists here. We actually considered doing a lot of the recording and filming live, not live, but at the actual talks, just recording them directly. But it's paleontologists addressing other paleontologists, and there wouldn't be any real explanation of any terminology unless we cut audio into it, which would be a bit messy. And even I get lost in a lot of the talks when they're talking about a lot of the taxonomy or terminology of a group of animals that I'm not familiar with. So I thought it might be pretty hard. So what we're going to be doing instead is during the coffee breaks, I'm going to go off into the crowd of people, see who we can pull out, and then get them to talk to us directly, break down the research a bit more so that I'm able to understand it. And we'll get them into our mini little recording studio, which University College Dublin has provided us, which is pretty nice. So let's see what we get. Before the conference started on the second day, I managed to get a quick look at some of the posters that had been brought, and one that stood out as being pretty unusual was by Dr. Tom Challens of the British Geological Survey and the University of Edinburgh on Save the Fishes, which is a paleo conservation project. Now, normally with conservation, you're trying to stop organisms from dying. However, with paleo conservation, you're trying to save an organism which died 400 million years ago. It sounded pretty interesting, so I cornered Tom in the cafe. Yeah, so we just took 5 minutes and I've caught up with Tom Challens. You've got a poster here today. Tom, could you tell us a bit about that?
That's right. My poster here today is talking about a project that I'm currently involved in about fossil fish that have been found in paving slabs in Edinburgh.
All right, paving slabs. Was this something that someone was just walking along and they just noticed the fish?
Yep, quite literally. There's an amateur geologist who was walking. He's taking his children, actually, to Dynamic Earth, which is a geology science centre in Edinburgh. And he happened to just chance upon these small black bones in the pavement. And from there, he got in touch with Dr. Al McGowan from the University of Glasgow. And from there, that started a series of reactions, so to speak, that has now led to us extracting these fossil fish from the pavements, having negotiated with the City of Edinburgh Council and the Scottish Parliament, and now we're studying them and looking for more.
How easy was it to actually get the fossils out from the pavement, both in terms of talking to the council and getting permission to do it, and then physically actually removing the fish?
So, I have to say, Al did all the negotiations with the City of Edinburgh Council, but they were really, really interested in the project. They thought it was unique, it's unusual, and it grabbed their attention to know that there's this geological heritage literally on their doorstep. So they were very enthusiastic. They very kindly donated the slabs to us and also paid for their extraction, as did the Scottish Parliament when we contacted them to see how we could extract some of the fish from outside their building. The actual extraction was pretty straightforward. It was obviously done by contractors rather than just us going in with our jackhammers and crowbars. So what they did is they had to cut the slab out using a large circular steel saw, put crowbars down the side to wiggle it about. And after that, once the slab is loose, there are two ways you can lift it out. You can either hook it out with two sort of keys, long keys, bent bits of metal, and four people lift it out. Or you can get this really interesting contraption, which literally sticks and sucks to the slab, sucks it out, and then you can pull it out either using brute force, or in one of the cases, we had to get a forklift truck to actually lift it out.
So how many fish have you found altogether?
Around Edinburgh, currently we found about 20, and of these, five are probably really, really good, really well-preserved good fish that we can identify. We've managed to identify two of them pretty conclusively, and these belong to taxa known as Dacostius and Dipterus. But we're still looking at identifying the other ones. The rest of the material is just scales or skull fragments, and you know, it's stuff that's not really spectacular to look at, but kind of interesting in its own right, because it's unusual from the main pavement rock type itself.
Whereabouts in Edinburgh were these fish? Was it any problem to actually dig them out? Were they on the main street?
So the first ones were on a place called East Market Street, which is right outside the main railway station, Edinburgh Railway Edinburgh Waverley railway station. And that is a busy street. It's on the main thoroughfare to the City of Edinburgh Council buildings. And obviously being next to the station, it's busy. So they had to close the parking bays off and obviously barrier off the area we're extracting. But you know, business really continued as normal. With respect to the Parliament, they're actually undergoing some building works there. So extraction of the fish from the pavements was effectively a rescue operation before they were built on themselves. So the whole area was cordoned off there anyway, and that was pretty easy to do, relatively straightforward.
If you walk around any town that's got buildings made out of natural stone, you might see a lot of fossils in them. What is it about this fish, these fish especially, that makes them worthy of saving?
Right, well, there's a couple of things. I mean, there's several aspects that make this interesting. One of them is obviously the historical, the cultural and geological heritage aspect to them. But specifically, there's only two quarries currently extracting this stone from Caithness up in the northeast of Scotland. And one of these quarries is a SSSI, a site of special scientific interest. And it's been designated, given that designation because it's yielded some very important fish, some holotype specimens of taxa in the past. The other place, a place known as Achstrabster Quarry, has had fish recorded from it before, but they're very rare from there. More interestingly, Spittle Quarry, the SSSI, has recently exposed a new bone bed, a new fish bed, which is yielding some very well-preserved fish, some interesting types of preservation, and these rocks, these slabs, are now being exported as paving slabs throughout the UK. So that's what makes it interesting, the fact that historically these quarries have yielded important fish, and now they've recently found a new fish bed.
Do you think it might be possible to trace where all of these paving slabs are being sent out to and try and find some more fish?
Well, that is the hope. That's the plan. What we really want to do is encourage people to look in the pavements, look for more fish in the towns and cities that they live in. What we do know is that these paving slabs are becoming a more and more popular medium to pave the streets of cities throughout the UK, but not just the UK, but Paris has got these slabs, and they've also been found in Buenos Aires and in Australia.
And do they have fish in them as well?
I can't say about Buenos Aires or Australia, but there's always the potential because the Caithness flagstones are very, very well known for yielding fish.
So are you going to be doing any kind of analysis on these fishes?
We're doing some analysis on the actual structure of the fish, but what this has led to is it's led us to look in more detail at the type of fish and certain aspects of the preservation of the type of fish that we're finding in the slabs. For instance, Dipterus, which is a small fossil lungfish that is found from these slabs, is very, very common, and typically it's preserved as scales in the skull and some fins. You don't often see the internal skeleton, the backbone, the ribs and supports of the fins themselves. Now, there are other similar fish, dipterids, other types of lungfish, and they don't often preserve their backbone. So what we've been doing is going around the collections and trying to find remnants of axial skeletons and fin supports in these other dipterid, these other dipnoan lungfish taxa. They are Pentlandia and Pinnalongus, which was only described in 2005, so it's a relatively new taxon. We don't know too much about it. One of our other aims is to look at the geochemistry of this new fish bed that's been found in Spittle Quarry. We know there's a very well-preserved, very famous fish bed from Achnarus Quarry, which is only about a kilometre or two away from Spittle Quarry. Spittle Quarry lies stratigraphically above Achnarus Quarry, so we're anticipating the type of preservation will be slightly different, and the taxa are slightly different, the abundance of fish are different, and we want to understand why. What we'll also do is do some micro sampling through the sediment, through the individual laminae, to look at effects of runoff from the land into these ancient Orcadian, as they're known, Orcadian lake systems, to see whether runoff was potentially important for the preservation and the formation of these fish beds, or, as previous studies have done, look at the abundance of algal blooms in the lake that may have caused mass mortality, has basically sucked out all the oxygen from the lake system and killed all the fish off. We want to know if that's happened in this fish bed to see and test whether or not it is the same system for the formation of these fish beds throughout the entire lake.
Thanks very much, Sam.
My pleasure.
Next up, and from another poster, I spoke to Sam Giles from the University of Oxford, who's trying to better understand the early evolution of the ray-finned fishes by using modern techniques to look at their internal skeletal structure. All right, so we've managed to find Sam Giles, who's a PhD student at Oxford, and she's got a poster here today. Could you tell us a bit about what you're doing?
So my PhD is looking at early fish evolution. And if you think about the kind of living vertebrate diversity today, you've got essentially two main groups. You've got things that we call the bony fish, because they have a bony skeleton, and things that we call the cartilaginous fish, because they have a cartilaginous skeleton. And the bony fish are made up of things called ray fins, which are things like tuna and goldfish, basically something that you would see in an aquarium or on a dinner plate, and things called the lobe fin fishes, which are made up of kind of coelacanths and lungfish and tetrapods. And those groups make up about 50,000-60,000 species. By contrast, the chondrichthyans, the cartilaginous fish, which are things like sharks and rays and skate, have only about 900 species. The only other living vertebrates are the hagfish and lampreys. They're jawless vertebrates, and there are only about 20 species of those today. So the vast majority of kind of vertebrate diversity is held within these bony fish. And about 50% is in the lobe-fin fishes, and about 50% is in the ray-fin fishes. But we actually know a lot more about the early evolution of the lobe fins, because they eventually gave rise to tetrapods. So they're seen as much more interesting, because we can look at things like evolution of life on land. And
it's a weird, weird tetrapods, aren't we?
Yes, so we're tetrapods.
So is every mammal or lizard on land a tetrapod as well?
So tetrapods are things like, they include birds and mammals and reptiles and dinosaurs and us. So we're all lobe-fin fishes, essentially.
All right, okay. So there's just as many of these fish that you see, the ray-fin fish that we see in the aquarium, there's about the same number of species of those as there are terrestrial vertebrates, so humans, mammals, birds, reptiles, amphibians.
Fact, yeah, in fact, there are more ray-fin fishes than there are land vertebrates. But much less has been done on their evolution. So my PhD is looking at the early evolution of this group and trying to work out how the character suite in early ray-fins differs from that in early lobe-fins. So lobe-fins have gone on to create all tetrapods, as we just said, but ray-fins have kind of stayed in the ocean and diversified into very, very diverse fish, but still they're all marine animals. So I'm using an animal called Chirolepis, which is the first known ray-fin fish. It's from the Devonian, so it's about 380 million years old. And it's known from a number of sites in Scotland and a couple of sites in Canada. But because it's so old, it's not necessarily fossilised in very good condition. So we took a specimen that's been lying around in a museum for quite a while, and we scanned it using a thing called a synchrotron, which is like a really, really high-powered X-ray machine. So if you think about, if you break a bone, you go to hospital, you get an X-ray of whatever bone you've broken. It's the same principle as that, but it's much, much higher. So if a human went into a synchrotron X-ray facility, you'd get some very, very horrible radiation poisoning, because it's a much higher beam energy. It's much, much stronger. But that means that we can use it to X-ray rocks and see the structure of fossils inside of them. So that's what I've been doing with this animal, Chirolepis.
Okay, have you noticed any characters, any specific morphologies of this fossil that can tell us about the evolution of the ray-fin fishes?
Yeah, so this fish actually has a complete brain case preserved inside it. So the brain case is found in the head. It's part of the internal skeleton, so it's not very often preserved. But because it sort of surrounds the brain case and the eyes and similar sensory structures in your head, it's actually got loads and loads of information in it. So we can use it to look at its morphology, and we can compare it to the morphology of early lobe-fin fishes. And we actually see that the brain case of Chirolepis has a number of features which we wouldn't necessarily expect to see in early ray fins based on more derived ray fins that also have brain cases preserved. So it's got, there's a feature called the dorsal aorta, and the dorsal aorta is it's a blood vessel which supplies all of the blood to the head. And in ray fin fishes, this is meant to be kind of enclosed in a canal, so it's completely surrounded by bone, and that's a ray fin fish synapomorphy. But we see in Chirolepis that actually it's got an open dorsal aorta, so there's a kind of groove on the brain case, but the blood vessel itself would have been not encased in bone fully. So that tells us quite a lot about what early ray fins look like. And as you might expect, early ray fin fishes don't look like later ray fin fishes. But because our current picture of ray fin fish evolution is built on more derived animals, we currently have an inaccurate picture. So we need to re-examine early fish like Chirolepis to get a kind of better understanding of what they actually look like in the most primitive members of this group. And when we've done that, we can compare it to what these features look like in early lobe fins and members of other group, and try and understand how these animals have diverged to create such radically different body plans.
All right, thank you very much. Ontogeny, the growth and development of an organism, is something that we can clearly see in living animals, but it's something we can't as easily see in the fossil record. Something as simple as size comparisons can be made in groups such as mammals, but how do we compare adults and juveniles in groups such as arthropods, where the juveniles can have larval stages and look nothing like the adult form? We spoke to James Lansdell, a PhD student from the University of Kansas. Right, so with us now is my good friend James Lansdell, who works a lot on Eurypterids, which you all know I'm very fond of. So James has been looking at how we deal with ontogeny in working out the relationships between species in the fossil record. So first of all, could you tell us how we actually define a species?
Okay. Well, for modern animals, basically, you can define a species fairly easily by either looking at its genetics and seeing how divergent the DNA is from different populations. And you can also do it essentially by seeing if they breed, whether they produce offspring that can themselves breed. So that's whether they can produce viable offspring.
Okay, so something like a horse and a donkey producing a mule, they would be considered the separate species because a mule is not a fertile offspring.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay.
In the fossil record, however, we've got this problem where we can't get genetic information, and we can't see if things were breeding or what their offspring did. So we have to rely on how they look, so their morphology and the characteristics that they're presenting. And this leads to problems given how arthropods in particular grow.
Okay, so what is it about how arthropods grow that means that we can't look at their morphologies?
Okay, so arthropods undergo an unusual sort of growth pattern compared to, say, mammals. Mammals will just change shape as they grow and increase in size. Not necessarily constantly, but in a sort of even curve. Arthropods, however, have this hard external skeleton, and this means that for most of the time they can't grow much at all. So they undergo molt events where they shed the external exoskeleton, will undergo very rapid growth over a short period of time, then the exoskeleton will harden, and then they basically cease growing again, and that period is called an instar. The thing is, as well, they can change their actual morphology, not just size, but the actual shape of the animal quite drastically. And there are two types of development that we see in this. You either have your direct developers, where the young look just like miniature versions of the adults, or you have indirect developers, such as crustaceans, where the young have these larval forms that bear no relation to the adults at all.
So would an example of an indirect developer be something like a caterpillar to a butterfly?
Yeah, exactly. And as you can see, caterpillars have almost no structures that you can compare to the adults at all. What I was particularly interested in, however, is with indirect developers, because we have our crustaceans and insects today that are indirect developers, we can kind of see what the larval forms look like. And we know when we have larva, and we know that we can't compare these directly to the adults. The trouble is, for direct developers, which include things like spiders and scorpions, we have two types. There are the true direct developers, where the juvenile look exactly like the adults, and then what is called hemianomorphic development, where the juveniles look a lot like the adults, but have fewer segments or fewer limbs, and will gain these as they grow.
Okay, so is that something like a trilobite being born with two segments and then later having five, six, seven?
Exactly, segments. And then each time it molts, it will add one segment, and that is basically how you end up with your multiple segmented adult trilobites.
Okay, so has there been problems with actually defining them as species? Have people seen juveniles with, say, two segments, compared them to adults with five segments, and said, these are two different species because this one's got two and this one's got five segments?
Yeah, this has happened quite a bit in the past, and a recent study that I was looking at has been done on fossil horseshoe crabs, and there is a genus of predominantly carboniferous horseshoe crab called Euprops. And a number of species have been named, often based on changes in head shape or in the extremities of the body segments, which we term pleura or epimera, and how they come off in a spike-like fashion. However, this recent study showed that in a single species of Euprops, you could get each of these shapes and morphologies as it molted, so that the juveniles were spikier and had flatter heads, and as they got older, the heads became more rounded and the spines kind of receded.
So what happens if we don't get an entire suite of molting events from the very youngest to the very oldest? How can we say that one is a juvenile, one is an adult, and what's in between?
I mean, this is basically the crux of the problem. It's very difficult to know how to do that without either comparing with species where we do have it or looking into the modern. One thing you can do, though, is if you've got multiple specimens and you suspect that they might be the same species, you can plot dimensions of, say, head length and width. And if they sort of plot along a regression line, this is an indication that these shapes are co-varying and that they are more likely perhaps to be different stages of the same animal rather than actually different animals altogether.
So can you work this from the other way around, in that if you look at a graph of length and width ratios, if you get clusters of specimens which have similar length and width ratios, can you separate these off from each other and say that this is the first molt, this is the second molt, this is the third, and those are the relative proportions that you're likely to have?
Yeah, that's pretty much how we do it. It's important, though, as well, to not just look at the dimensions, but look at other aspects of the animal. So, for example, in Eurypterids, you can tell the molts based off carapace dimensions, but you can also see that the legs and the head tend to be much, much longer on juveniles and then a shorter on adults. And again, you can also see that the projections on the body segments are much, much more pronounced on juveniles and reduced in the adults. So when you look at the ratios and you can see different clusterings, and then if you can see other extra morphological examples of things that clearly define the different groups, then you can start to say that these are different instars.
Okay, what would you do for non-direct developers, though?
That is a fairly tricky issue. Basically, you have to rely quite a bit on comparison with the modern. There was another talk at the conference that suggested we could use phylogenetic analysis to see where these larval forms plot together. And I think that's got some mileage, and you can definitely use that to see which larvae are more closely related to each other if you're comparing exactly the same stages.
One of the most interesting talks from the first day and the Taphonomy Symposium was How to Thonomy Distorts Phylogeny by Dr. Rob Sanson of the University of Manchester. Rob has been performing decay experiments on living groups to see what kind of information is lost during the fossilisation process, and then how these carcasses compare to related organisms in the fossil record. All right, I've managed to catch up with Rob Sanson from Manchester University, who gave a talk on taphonomy and how it distorts phylogeny. So could you give us a bit more information on that, please?
Sure. So fossils, obviously, are really important for helping us understand evolutionary processes. Everyone here is, you know, that's what they're looking at, that's what they're talking about. But in order to use fossils in that sort of context, you need to be able to place them accurately in a phylogeny, that is, an evolutionary tree, a sort of framework of understanding. So to do that, you use their anatomy to look at the best placement, the most parsimonious placement. But, of course, there's a difficulty there with the way that you use fossils. Fossils are different from modern organisms. They've been subjected to these processes of fossilisation, and they've lost a lot of information, they've changed, they've distorted, they've collapsed. And that missing data could have a role, and that's what I've been talking about.
So how can we estimate what kind of data we've lost? Do things lose pretty similar kind of information?
Well, there are two important ways in which data can be lost during fossilisation. In the most common example, if we think of the sorts of fossils that we're most familiar with, if we look at ammonites or shells or skeletons of dinosaurs, what we're left with is this sort of hard skeleton, this when we've lost a lot of the soft tissue characteristics like hair, muscles, or nervous tissue. So that's a very simple distinction we can make between those hard bits and pieces of information relating to skeletons and shells and the soft bits and pieces of information that from those other characters. So when we look at that difference, we can see some important patterns emerging, and actually some surprising patterns emerging, in the sense that there are real differences between those kinds of fossilizable data and non-fossilizable data. When we take them into account, it can actually change the way we interpret fossils and what they can tell us about their evolution processes.
So have you tried to model this in any way?
Yep. So when you're looking at that kind of fossilisation whereby you're dealing with a loss of soft information, the best thing to do is focus upon living groups, whereby we can take all that data that we have available and subject them to hypothetical fossilisation filters. So we can therefore look at the kinds of signal, the kinds of information provided by soft characteristics and hard characteristics in living groups, and then see what would happen if we effectively fossilise them. What happens if we take a living group and are subjected to fossilisation filters? Does the resulting picture we see afterwards differ in systematic ways from what we were looking at before?
And are there any patterns that have come out of looking
yes.
at this?
Yes. So one problem is that things, your resolution, your ability to build evolutionary trees reduces. The amount of resolution you get from those trees reduces. So that's a shame, because that means that you know, you're less able to use the fossil record to build those trees than you are in otherwise random data, missing data. But more worryingly is that there can be systematic distortions within that. And in fact, actually, when you make individual taxa extinct in this hypothetical way, they can actually potentially slide down the tree and appear look more primitive than they otherwise would have been. Now, if that process is taking place, the evolutionary conclusions we draw from fossil taxa could be wrong, because they may appear primitive just because of the sheer the intrinsic process of fossilization, which is, you know, all fossils will have been fossilized by definition. And if that process causes them to appear more primitive, then we may end up making the wrong sorts of conclusions unless we take this sort of bias into account. The other kind of fossilisation is where you're dealing with more subtle changes, whereby you don't have skeletal information, you're dealing with entirely soft-bodied organisms. And when you have entirely soft-bodied organisms, it's decay, the processes of decay and decomposition that are paramount to helping us understand those sorts of things. So under those circumstances, we again turn to modern organisms as a source of information in that context, but we don't subject them to these hypothetical filters. We have to actually experimentally investigate what happens to them. So we can take modern proxies for early conditions of some early clades, and the example that I've been working on is looking at early vertebrates. And if you take those, you can rot them in a rather stinky lab and see what happens and the loss of information during that process.
And then have there been patterns of information loss? Certain things more likely to be lost than other things?
Indeed, yeah. We have this problem in vertebrates whereby the bits and pieces of anatomical information lost during decay just happen to be those ones that are more informative to help you place things accurately in the tree of life. And as decay progresses, what you're left with is this organism that appears more primitive in some senses because it lacks those important bits and pieces of information. So decay, again, is causing organisms to appear more primitive than they were in life. And unless you take that process into account, you can end up making mistaken interpretations of your fossils. However, I should emphasise that this isn't for a moment suggesting that we can throw away Darwinian principles and that all fossils are the decayed remains of something else, and actually evolution doesn't happen in that regard. When you apply these kinds of principles to the fossil data, you begin to understand that some of those fossils maybe need to be more cautiously treated and in fact could be decayed remains and may appear primitive but in fact could be something else, whereas we can use the decay data also to identify those fossils that do have real evolutionary significance and can help us understand and interpret key evolutionary scenarios, in this context vertebrates. But that's just only for one part of the tree. Whether or not this process exists elsewhere and is a more general phenomenon for all those other sorts of organisms that have soft bodies like worms or arthropods, we don't really know currently.
One of the most famous locations for finding fossils is the Burgess Shale in the Canadian Rockies of British Columbia. Dated at around 500 million years old and discovered in 1909, the Burgess Shale remains one of the oldest and best-known sites where soft body preservation of organisms can be found. The Burgess Shale has been a treasure trove of information, so much so that research is focused on just one small quarry in the mountainside. However, newer explorations of the surrounding areas have yielded more fossil-bearing localities, and comparisons of these sites can lead to a better understanding of the ecosystems at the time. We spoke to Lorna O'Brien from the University of Toronto.
So I'm working on a paleo-community analysis of one of the Burgess Shale localities called the Tulip Beds. And the reason I'm looking at this locality is that we have a lot of ecological data about the Walcott Quarry, which is the most famous Burgess Shale locality. Mm-hmm. But we don't actually know anything about the ecology of any of the sites outside of that main locality. And that is what I'm trying to do for my PhD.
Are there many differences in terms of the kind of animals that you get between the localities?
Yes, so while there are a lot of animals in common and the diversity is quite similar, we have a large difference in the abundance of animals that we find. And we have a lot of new and undescribed taxa at the Tulip Beds that have not been seen at the Walcott Quarry.
Okay, how far apart are these two quarries, and in both geographical and temporal terms?
So geographically, we're about 5 kilometres away from the Walcott Quarry. The Walcott Quarry is on Fossil Ridge, and the Tulip Beds is on Mount Stephen, the same area as the Trilobite Beds. But stratigraphically, we're older than the Walcott Quarry, one of the oldest Burgess Shale localities. And it's also spatially a little bit different from the Walcott and the Trilobite Beds in that we have material deposited in a more distal setting, so further out away from the escarpment.
So in the deeper water?
Yes.
Okay, so is the difference in the animals, is that because of the paleobathymetry, how deep the water is, or is it because of the time difference?
I think it's a combination of the two. So for example, we have different species of some of the taxa because of that time difference, so you're getting species turnover. But I think the main abundance differences between the two locality is actually driven by those by that distal setting, in that you have a lot of attached sessile suspension feeding animals further down away from the escarpment than what you're finding at the Walcott Quarry.
What is the proposed preservation method of the Tulip Beds?
So it's similar to other Burgess Shale type preservation at the Bridger Shale and other localities. So we have rapid preservation, 2D carbonaceous compressions, and they're getting preserved by mud flow deposits that were very rapid events that just smothered entire communities.
So there's a turbidites, aren't they? Kind of like, is it like underwater mud avalanche?
Pretty much, or it could probably, because we're so distal and I just have millimeter thick beds, it's probably something a little bit more gentle than that. So it's more the distal end of a turbidite or a storm driven event.
Is it possible then that the animals are actually allochthonous, like they don't actually belong there, they were swept in with the event?
That is possible, but most of the evidence that we have supports the idea that they are close to in situ or close to their living environment. So we have specimens that are quite large for the size of the beds that they're found in. So for example, Cyphosactum gregarum, which is a new taxa described from this locality, can be up to 25 centimeters in length, and it's it is preserved in a millimeter thick bed. And then we have a huge range of sizes preserved together, which you wouldn't expect if they were being moved very far. And we don't get a huge amount of sediment between the individual specimens that we find, which suggests that they haven't been moved along in a mud slurry for very long.
Do you think it's possible that there are still more Burgess Shale type localities to be found?
Yes. Most definitely. We're finding more and more every time we go out and do field work. More localities are being found, and we keep, as we search more, we definitely are finding more. So it is just a case of worker effort, in that some of these sites are incredibly difficult to get to, and it's all about trying to find the right lithology or rock type, and you can be pretty confident you're going to find some kind of Bridger Shale type faunas in most areas in this particular basin.
Alright, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Finally, we spoke to Dr. Peter Forkingham of the Royal Veterinary College and Brown University on using penetrative tracks to reconstruct dinosaur limb kinematics.
Yeah, so my talk's looking at reconstructing limb kinematics of dinosaurs, so the way the foot moves in these, and we're using fossil footprints. We've got these really nice deep tracks where the foot has sunk down. So this foot that's maybe 10 centimetres long has gone in 7 centimetres deep, cutting through the mud. And so we can use that, and we can break apart the rock and work backwards to figure out exactly what the foot was doing. And then we're comparing that to how the way birds move today, and seeing similarities and differences. And it turns out there's some big differences, and we're trying to figure out why there are differences there. Whether it's evolutionary differences between, you know, these 200 million year apart ancestor and descendants, or whether it's to do with the kind of sediment they're walking over, how deep the mud is and things like this.
That's a pretty thorough description. I'm not quite sure what questions to ask there.
So in order to look at this, some of the methods that we're using, we have computer simulation. I've done computer simulation in the past of tracks. We've taken this to the next level and doing cool things. But really, that's only there to test the hypothesis of the motion itself, which we've got from the fossil track. By using free open source photogrammetry, we can produce digital models of the footprint specimens, and then rotate and look at those in 3D using Maya to locate where parts of the foot have passed. And then in conjunction with that, we're looking at modern extant taxa using XROM, which is biplanar X-rays. So we fire X-rays from two angles, and then we can triangulate the location of all the bones. So we can take a CT scan of the bird, and we can load that bird into Maya, into 3D space. And then as we get it walking over the substrate, we can see what the foot is doing beneath the surface of the mud, which it turns out we're trying to look at what the dinosaurs did. We don't even really know how birds walk over mud.
One thing I want to know is that with trace fossils, you can't always assign a producer to it.
Right.
So how do you constrain the model of the foot without knowing the actual morphology of all the bones?
Right. That's a really good question. Somebody asked me after my talk, do you know what kind of animal made the track? And I said, yes, a small bipedal dinosaur, because that's as accurate as we can get. It was probably a theropod. We have theropod skeletons from the area. But luckily, the foot morphology of theropods is actually very conservative. It's always three toes. It's always a phalangeal formula of 2, 3, 4. So that's the number of bones in each digit. And you know, there's only so much you can do with three toes. And you can work backwards. You can get the morphology of the foot from the track. So, for instance, in the 3D volume, we look at the paths that the foot has taken, and we can constrain that digit 3, the middle digit, had to be about 6 centimetres long in order to create the point where the digits meet and the tip of digit 3. So we can work backwards that way and get the sizes of the feet. But no, we can't identify these things to species level or anything like that. Not yet, anyway.
Were you able to accurately reconstruct a similar kind of substrate?
So this is one of the really hard things. We can see the grain size, obviously, from the rock, and we can take account of deformation and diagenesis to an extent, but something like moisture content is essentially lost from the fossil record. And we end up in this circular argument where we determine the moisture content by the way the footprint has been made. So then you end up trying to reproduce a substrate that makes the same track, and you end up in this cyclical argument, essentially. So what we do is we do a range of substrates, and we look at the differences in the kinematics over those substrates. And perhaps we can produce the same track in multiple substrates, or perhaps we can't. Either way, we can learn about the kinematics that way.
And are you able to learn anything about the physiology of the animal, like how much it weighs? Or
a lot of people ask me about weighing dinosaurs from the footprints. Some people say it can be done. I'm not entirely convinced yet, but if people can figure it out, that's great. Because, of course, if the moisture content's gone, you don't know how soft the mud was, so you don't know how much force was applied. And the faster you move, the more force you apply through your feet. So it's difficult to say. Really, instead of the isolated tracks that I'm using in this study, you can get more physiological information from track weights. So you can look at stride length, calculate speed, and things like this. They give you much more insight into the general paleobiology of the animal, whereas we're looking at very specific motions that the animal could make.
Do you see yourself being able to use this model for other animals?
I hope so. So that is a major aim. Whilst it's a very specific study and we have some very specific tracks and we're looking at the motion in those, ultimately we're building up a methodology and a way of looking at these things that hopefully will be applicable to not just dinosaurs but any vertebrate footprint throughout the fossil record.
So I'm here at the annual dinner held at the Jameson Whiskey Distillery. I was actually very excited about this, being such a whiskey fan, well, at least the Scottish ones. But we had a champagne reception, and I wasn't allowed to buy a whiskey. So I think I'm the only person who can go into a whiskey distillery in Ireland and not get a whiskey. Well, at least got one at the end of the tour, so it's not all that bad. So as part of the meal that we're having here in the distillery, there's been an award ceremony hosted by Professor Mike Benton, who's the Palace President and also from the University of Bristol. Now, Dr. Jakob Winter of the University of Bristol as well received the Hodson Award, which is for notable contributions from early career paleontologists under the age of 35. We had Dr. Harry Dowsett from the USGS, United States Geological Survey, who was awarded the President's Medal, which is to recognise outstanding contributions from mid-career paleontologists. Alice Rasmussen of the Østjyllands Museum in Denmark received the Mary Anning Award for an outstanding contributions from a non-professional paleontologist. And Professor Ewan Clarkson from the University of Edinburgh received the Lapworth Medal for his significant contributions to science by means of a substantial body of research, particularly for his work on trilobite visual systems. Hopefully, this episode will have given you an insight into all of the talks, posters, discussions that go on at these kind of conferences. And we hope to be bringing more of this kind of episode to you in the future. In May this year, we're actually going to live stream the Progressive Paleontology Conference, which is for early career paleontologists and students, which is held under the Paleontological Association umbrella. That's going to be in Leeds this year in the UK. And lastly, I'd just like to quickly thank the organiser of this conference, Patrick Orr, for his hospitality here at the University College Dublin. And a big thanks to the paleontological community on the whole, whose support of PaleoCast in its first few months has been truly humbling. So a big thank you. I managed to get a great deal of networking done, and hopefully we're going to be having a lot of high profile interview announcements to make this year, which we're really, really excited about, so please keep listening. But as for now, I'm going to finish my dinner and get some whiskey. Thanks for listening.
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with John Tennant and Joe Keating. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association. Music was supplied by The Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material for this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at PaleoCast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.